This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to Bar None, the sports show that aims to motivate you to get out there and get sporty, as well as to inspire you. Now, a power in the house this week will definitely do just that. Julia Immonen gained 2 Guinness World Records for rowing across the Atlantic Ocean to raise awareness on human trafficking.
Oh, to turn round and see land for the first time after 6 weeks was... I mean, I even get lost for words now because it was just surreal to turn around and see Barbados there in all its glory. It was early in the morning.
Next, get on the ball with Jason Lim and I as we look at less heartbreaking, nail-biting alternatives to deciding World Cup matches than facing the dreaded penalty shootout.
It means you can sleep for the first 90 minutes and then just wake up for the last, I don't know, half hour or so after extra time, and that's it. Lots of tension, lots of drama. What else do you want?
And finally, think flat abs and lean legs. Let Tiki Shabudin, Les Mills body pump instructor, guide you through a typical body pump session to show you how easy it is to reach your goals.
And that's the beauty of body pump. More so than any other type of workout, you see results even as short as within a week.
Segment of Bar None with me, Angeline Tay. In 2011, the first all-female team of 5 gained 2 Guinness World Records for rowing across the Atlantic Ocean to raise awareness against human trafficking on a global scale. Julia Immonen, the founder of Sport for Freedom, led the team, which rowed almost 5,000 kilometers from the Canary Islands to the shores of Barbados. This is no mean feat if you think about it, because Christopher Columbus followed a similar route when he discovered America. The leader of the first female crew and also fastest female rowing team in the world to cross the Atlantic Ocean joins us today as our power in the house, Julia Immonen. Now, what brings you to Kuala Lumpur?
So I was invited by Frog Asia, who are an amazing educational kind of system. They connect education from urban areas right into remote areas and bring them together through education. So I'm really passionate about injustice of human trafficking, which was the reason behind the crazy row across the Atlantic. So it's that partnership really that's brought me here to KL.
So tell us the story behind Row for Freedom. Why human trafficking?
Yeah, I grew up in a very ordinary home. I kind of always thought that charity was what other people did. I didn't really think that I could ever make a difference.
All right, listen to me. Go to the next bedroom, under the bed.
Tell me when you're there.
Now, the next part is very important. They're going to take you.
And then after watching Taken, the film with Liam Neeson about 5.5 years ago, I kind of thought, surely that's just a film, that doesn't really happen. And then a few months later, I was at a conference and lo and behold, heard, you know, a whole presentation all about what I saw in the film about human trafficking, modern day slavery, the buying and selling of human beings. And my jaw was on the floor. I thought, how, as an ordinary educated girl who kind of knows what's going on in the news and in the world, do I not know about the largest, the fastest growing crime in the world? So I just felt really overwhelmed and heartbroken and just kind of thought I have to do something to make a difference. And sport is very much my world. I grew up in Lapland in Finland in the snow, skiing. And then I've always had a bit of an adventurous spirit, but have never done anything really extreme before. And really, one day I was running along the Thames in London with my best friend, and her friend had rowed the Atlantic Ocean, and she said at the end of the run, Julia, should we row the Atlantic? And I was like, yes, as if it was like grabbing a coffee from Starbucks or something really simple. And that's really where it started, and straight away I knew that this row, because it's symbolic of the transatlantic slave route, of slavery over 150 years ago, it was just a really extreme but amazing opportunity to raise awareness.
Do you personally know anyone who's been through human trafficking?
I do, yes. I the first girl, Nancy, who I met, she was actually from Mexico City and a lovely girl, and I met her just as I was on a flight, actually just about to board to go to America, and my friends were like, we really want you to meet her. So I met her in the airport and I literally sobbed all the way to America. And I just heard her tell me how she had gone, you know, under the false pretense of a job, you know, lured under the false pretense of a better job in the north of Mexico. And she was sold into sexual exploitation, sex slavery for 5 years. And just the way she was degraded, urinated on, I mean, had scorpions thrown on her. I mean, just the most degrading things. So it was a real privilege. And I've met girls in the UK who have been trafficked, exploited, you know, within the UK and abroad. So it's something that goes on globally and it's rife actually on all our doorstep, including here in Malaysia. Unfortunately.
And you know, setting off from the Canary Islands and finishing your journey on the shores of Barbados, none of you have wrote before, like you're saying, five ordinary girls. What made you think this was doable?
It was possible. I think the naivety was a complete blessing because I had no idea. Everyone was always like in the build up to it, kind of 18 months from start to finish, really. Some of the girls only got on 6 months before. So I think the naivety, I didn't have to, everybody thought we were always, you know, oh, you're training all the time. And yes, I had to learn to row, you know, we had to put on about 14 pounds, you know, a stone in muscle. So yes, exercise was hugely important, but actually to get to the start line was a massive achievement in itself. We had to raise over £100,000 just to get to the start line.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just think sometimes you don't know what lies ahead. Had I known what lied ahead of me, I'd have run a mile, but you can't get off. So it was a race of 17 crews and only actually 11 made it. I mean, it was the hardest thing of my life. I mean, physically excruciating, rowing 12 hours a day, but mentally was, I can't even begin to describe how tough it was. It was daily a struggle.
So tell us more about your team. You know, how did you get the five girls, the four other girls to agree to this crazy challenge?
Yeah, do you know, it was actually, I never worried about how I was going to recruit the team. It was just a really natural journey. So actually in that really tough time with my mum, I went on a holiday to Dubai and just had a bit of a break and was out with a bunch of friends. And through these friends, I met Katie, who rode with us. And she said, oh, I've taken a year out of the corporate world to pursue a large sporting challenge. And I said, well, I know exactly what you need to do. You need to come and row the Atlantic. And it's incredible how a girl from originally from Yorkshire in England, now living in Dubai, I would just say yes without even truly knowing me. But there's something about sport that an adventure that just connects with people. So she got on board, and then I was in Northern Ireland and through a friend again, was there for the weekend, and they said, there's this amazing girl called Kate, you must meet her. And sure enough I did, and she got on board. So it was a really natural journey. And then one of the other girls, Debbie, she worked for one of the two anti-trafficking charities that we raise money for. So I was having a meeting with her, just finding out what they were doing as an NGO, and you know, mentioned that I was rowing the Atlantic. So she emailed me straight away after the meeting saying, I want to do this with you. So it was just a really incredible story. And we were actually six girls. Who was supposed to be our skipper in America, she was committed the whole way. And then just in the build-up to the preparations leaving to go from the Canaries, she just really fell apart. And if you fall apart on land, you know, the race organisers advised us, if you fall apart on land, then you're not going to fare too well in 50-foot waves, you know. And so we had to take the really tough decision of going without her. So there were many twists and tales, wow. hence having to write this book.
So you took your 2 years to prepare before you set off.
So about 18 months from the very beginning of my best friend saying, let's do it. She pulled out. There was many twists and turns, but ultimately it ended
up...
Read the book. Ultimately, it ended up being, you know, putting together this team, and it's been absolutely life-changing. I feel like such a different person for having done it.
The night before you set off,
yeah.
You know, what's going through your mind? What was going through your mind?
Butterflies, like, you know, just putting your last message on Facebook. Okay, we're off tomorrow. And everybody, like, I had talked about it for 18 months. So, you know, sometimes you've talked about it for so long and then finally the day is here. the nerves were just, it's kind of going into the unexpected. I mean, this ocean, nothing could prepare you for it. No matter how much mental, physical training we did, nothing. So it was this unknown, not, you know, that was so nerve-wracking. So super nervous. I remember minutes before we left, I think Kate and I were running to the ferry terminal, like to the toilet, because we just were so nervous, you know. So that was a bit nerve-wracking, yeah.
And how long did the whole journey take?
So it was 6 weeks. So the current record before that was 50 days. So we were gunning for these two world records to be the first female five and the fastest women ever across. So for us, you know, some people, they kind of want to row and take it, not leisurely, but they can get out and swim in the ocean. But for us, we were really disciplined about our changeover. So the boat didn't stop the whole way. So it was kind of rowing 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So we would rotate our watches, our shifts, and just to keep the boat continuously going. So to know that we were going for these world records kept us really disciplined. So every time we changed over, we just had to make sure we were really disciplined, because every 30 seconds wasted every 2 hours over 6 weeks or however long we were going to be at sea for could add up to days.
Yeah, you've done the math.
Yeah. Every day we were doing the math, literally checking how many miles have we done? What do we need to achieve today? I mean, some days you were surfing 50-foot waves, so they're actually the conditions that you want, because it means you kind of go quicker. You get these southerly trade winds which push you over, whereas if it's a flat ocean, you literally pull every stroke, so it's really hard.
Isn't it a fear that your boat might capsize, though?
Yeah, many crews did capsize. Some lost their oars and were floating around for days waiting for the support. There is a support vessel, but we were the only crew who didn't see them, because many of them were, you know, capsizing, had rudders breaking. And actually, I'm very proud as the only female crew in this. We just kept enduring. We kept going. So, yeah, it was crazy.
All right, let me get this straight. How big is the boat?
So the boat is literally 29 foot, so 7 meters long. So it's tiny. Five girls in a 7 meter boat, two tiny cabins. The middle section is open with three rowing seats. But I have to say, everything that could go wrong went wrong.
What happened?
Probably the most significant thing was the water maker. So that desalinates the seawater so you can drink it. So we had to be completely unassisted. If we got any help from another vessel or the support boat, the world records wouldn't count. Well, on day 15, it blew up, and then it meant we had to hand pump water. So we were always a rower down 24 hours a day, because the further southwest we got towards Barbados, the hotter it got. So we had to literally hand pump water around the clock. So just this kind of team dynamics of being in this small boat, everyone's always like, did you argue, you know, what,
yeah.
You know, and actually you see the good, the bad, the up, the down, the ugly, the, you know, of each other. But we really, I have to say, we found, well, I know for me personally, I found somebody I didn't know existed by the time I got to Barbados. Like, you're kind of stripped of ego, you're stripped of pride, anything. Like, you really have to work as a team. And we were really united. So, yes, there were a few fallouts. And I really learned kind of perspective and patience. And, you know, if it's not going to matter in 2 years, just let it go, Julia. You know, don't get annoyed that she's singing at the top of her lungs at 2 a.m, trying to keep herself awake. Just let it go.
Tell me, how was it like? First couple of days must be very exciting, but there are stages. Is there a specific stage where it takes a toll on everyone?
The beginning, yes, we were excited, the adrenaline. However, we were really seasick. So the beginning was quite tough adjusting. I couldn't even get my head around what the nights were going to be like. So to row through the night and stuff was so tough. So I would say the beginning was really tough. And then the middle actually just felt like it all blurred into one, because you're, even though the ocean is so vast and it changes every day, and I never got bored of it, the middle section was quite, let's just put our head down and do the same thing every day for, you know, for a good sort of 3-4 weeks. But I would say actually the end was the hardest. You thought with the end being near that it would be the easiest, but actually I found it, we were near but yet so far, and it just felt like the whole way across you miss your family. You're dreaming of fresh fruit and food, and you know, I dreamt of just being able to stand up and go to the toilet on a toilet and not on a bucket in 50-foot waves. Often in the end, when you know you're nearly there, that's sometimes the hardest thing.
Come on, Katie! Come on, Katie!
Incredible. absolutely unbelievable. Did you see her fall off the boat?
Just amazing that she's home safe and just done a fantastic job. I can't believe you how much it means to get her back safe. And haven't seen her since the beginning of December, and we're going to have Christmas dinner as soon as she gets home.
How did it feel when you finally see the land of Barbados?
Oh, to turn round and see land for the first time after 6 weeks was, I mean, I even get lost for words now, because it was just surreal to turn around and see Barbados there in all its glory. It was early in the morning, and then we had to row all day and all night until we got there. And then we did get there, and just to have... There were hundreds of locals, media, our family, and we were completely overwhelmed. Like, I got goosebumps talking about it now. I mean, it was just this euphoria and relief, actually relief of, oh, thank God we made it. And, you know, we just wanted to get there so that people would listen about human trafficking. And we got the world records, and that meant that people did listen and the media did want, you know, I wouldn't be sat here today. No. I wouldn't be here in KL if you know, Frog Asia hadn't have said, come and share your story. So we're really glad that we made it. And actually the adventure really started also when we got off the boat, because this is now the opportunity to share why and how, and, you know.
So does this feat open doors for you in any ways?
Yeah, we've just had the most incredible time since we got back. I mean, I hated public speaking years ago, but I've kind of learned to really enjoy and love it now. But just the opportunity to go around the world, you know, America and all over the place, originally from Finland, so lots in Scandinavia, just to really inspire others that, hey, if we can do it, I'm really, truly just completely ordinary. If we can do this, you can truly do anything.
So, like, 18 months from now, I'm able to, you know,
absolutely
go across the
could. I'm going to sign you up. I'm
okay,
sign
let's
you
do
up.
This. I'm going to do this. So, what are some of your plans for the future? I realized last September you swapped boat for bikes.
Yes. Do you know what? That's actually happening this October. So, if you've got any friends in the UK, tell them that they need to come and cycle with us. So, we're cycling from the north of England, Liverpool, which was a big slave port of the past, and we're cycling through five cities. Birmingham, Bristol, Oxford, with the big universities, to London. Nottingham, sadly. How do you know Nottingham?
I was studying in Nottingham.
Oh, you were at Nottingham. Okay. Sadly not, but it's not far. So yeah. People could come to Liverpool or to Birmingham. Then the finale is on Anti-Slavery Day, October the 18th, where 300 of us will be cycling the Olympic cycling route. So it's just a really practical way for people to get involved, to make a difference. Right. So we're really excited.
You'll be cycling 2,300 kilometres.
So it's actually 500 miles in 5 days.
Right, so do you have any advice for people out there who too dream of doing something difficult or impossible for a good cause?
I absolutely do. Do you know, there was a boat in our race called Dream It, Do It. And that is my motto. I'm literally like, dream it and do it. Like, you really... Yes, it's going to be hard often to get there. Any place worth going isn't easy. But my goodness, I wouldn't change the struggles, the setbacks, the challenges, the, you know, the sores, the awful things that we had to endure. Because, you know, I've often thought about, why is it that I want to keep doing these adventures and keep putting myself through these things? And it's because, you know, often in adventure, you're tired, you're hungry, you're wet, you're, you know, exhausted. But actually, you become a different person. You find something in you that you wouldn't if you didn't go through such a tough time. Yeah. So dream it and do it.
Thank you so much for your time, Julia.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here.
I've been speaking to Julia Immonen. She's the founder of Sport for Freedom. And so try catch up for the Cycle for Freedom that's starting in
October.
This is Bar None for BFM 89.9.
Coming up, get on the ball and up to date as we discuss if a penalty shootout is the most practical option to deciding a match at the World Cup. BFM 89.9.
How do you feel about World Cup matches being decided by penalty shootouts?
I want to die watching them, so I don't know how I feel because I'm too busy dying of excitement to think properly.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to On The Ball on Bar None with Jason Lim and me, Audrey Raj. Good morning, Jason.
Morning, Audrey.
So the second round of the World Cup has been one to remember, with most matches going to extra time, and two of them, the Brazil versus Chile and Costa Rica-Greece match, going to penalty shootouts. Now, I personally find shootouts thrilling, but I can understand how it can make some fans feel uncomfortable, especially if you're partial to one of the teams.
Yes, Audrey, for the Brazil and Chile match, it was really a cliffhanger for me. And when finally the Chile player hit the crossbar with his last penalty, my heart was literally in my throat.
Oh, but you know, my dad too kept lamenting all week, Jace, about how unfair it is for something as critical as a spot in the quarterfinals to be decided via a penalty shootout, let alone a spot in the finals or even the championship. Now, this got me thinking, are there better ways to decide a World Cup match than to go to spot kicks? What about the final itself? Well, here's what some of our friends around the office had to say. Do you think it's fair for matches at the World Cup to be decided by a penalty shootout?
Yes, it is. Because it's a coin flip. If they can't settle it in 120 minutes, the only other thing is to do is to either have a penalty shootout or a coin flip.
It's damn exciting. I mean, I know people wanted, you know, kind of on the field, you know, with the game. But I don't know. I think it's another dimension. It gives goalkeepers a chance to be in the limelight. I really love that.
A lot of people say it's a lottery, but I think that it takes a lot of skill to put the ball in the net under all that pressure. You know.
So you think it's fair?
I think it's very fair and it's exciting, and I look forward to it, especially after a boring match.
Well, I'm always very tired when it comes to that, you know, after watching so long. But I think I like to watch it too, because it's like it's a battle of like mentals between the goalkeeper and the penalty taker. I like that.
I love it. It means you can sleep for the first 90 minutes and then just wake up for the last, I don't know, half hour or so after extra time, and that's it. Lots of tension, lots of drama. What else do you want?
Well, there you have it. But you know, Audrey, before the introduction of shootouts, knockout matches level at extra time would be decided on a replay or a coin toss.
Coin toss?
Yeah, that's so random, and it's like 50-50 chance, right? After you've played a whole game. And in major competitions, when a replay or playoff was not possible, ties were decided by drawing of lots.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah.
Okay, but how did this penalty shootout come about?
Well, interestingly, it was an idea of an Israeli, Yusuf Dagan. He is credited with originating the modern penalty shootout. It was actually after his Israeli team lost in the 1968 Olympic quarterfinals by the drawing of lots. And interestingly, a Malaysian, Ko Ui Tek, a Malaysian FA member in the referees committee, pushed for the move. And after all the red tape, it was implemented in 1970.
Well, if you look at it that way, Jay's shootouts look like a better option than a coin toss, because it comes down to the actual skill of your team's players, not leaving it to chance. But there have been other ways employed to decide knockouts, right? I mean, remember the golden ball or golden... Yeah.
That was in 1996. FIFA introduced the golden goal.
Ah, golden goal. There you go.
The golden goal at Euro 96. And what this means is that if the match went to extra time, the first team to score immediately wins the match. Or it's basically a sudden death concept, right?
Oh, yes, I remember those. Those were painful as well.
Yeah, I mean, the final itself in Euro 96 between Germany and Czech Republic was won by the golden goal. And, well, a lot of fans, sort of, especially the Czech fans, of course, felt very cheated by this, you know. If we had applied this in our World Cup in right now, right, we would have cut many games short, maybe, and increased the attacking play of the teams, because teams wanted to score goals. But of course, opponents of the golden goal would say that the teams would be more defensive, because they'd be scared to lose possession. And of course, no one wants to lose possession and then be the one who lets in the goal, you see?
Yeah, they'd be holding on to the ball, so that could lead to a lot of time wasting as well.
Yeah, which arguably happened during the time they were trying out the system, right? And in 2003, FIFA introduced the silver goal, where the team leading after the first 15 minutes of extra time would win. Eventually, they just scrapped the whole system in 2004 in favor of a return to penalties.
Well, I guess the golden goal and the silver goal concept, well, it basically comes down to playing until someone scores first, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's simply not fair to the players to have a match continue until a goal is scored, because players run an average of like I don't know, like 15 miles during a match. And so anything more than the current 30 minutes of extra time, it would be too taxing on them. I mean, think of the muscle usage and fatigue and...
Yeah, you increase your chances of getting injured.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. But there was another suggestion by, well, this is coming from US Soccer, where I think they suggested to declare the winner of a tie of a match with the team taking the most corner kicks being declared the winner. Now, theoretically, this would be the team that had a better chance of play during the match, but sometimes the number of corner kicks doesn't really reflect the flow of the match or the final score, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And even more of a problem would be, well, I guess, you know, intelligent coaches would sort of strategize that they just keep kicking the ball towards the corner flag and in hopes of getting a corner.
Yeah, it'd be... More corner kicks than goals being scored.
Yeah, and I know there were some other suggestions like the most goals scored or the best goal difference or even the best record in the tournament. So if you've scored more goals in all your previous games, then you would be declared the winner. Do you think that's fair?
Well, that's something like a league concept, right? I mean, if in the Premier League you end up level on points and then you look at your goal difference, count back and all that. But I mean, it's stats, you know, and at the end of the day, it really take the excitement out of the game. And that's why I think penalties, well, love them or hate them, are here to stay, because up to the very last minute, there's so much tension and excitement, right?
Yes, it undoubtedly adds a lot of drama to tournaments, and that's what, well, most neutral fans look forward to, and that's what we'll be looking forward to at the World Cup. There's what, six matches left in the tournament?
Yes, and well, I hope there won't be penalties, but then if they are, well, I'll be waiting with bated breath once again.
I'm hoping there will be. Love it or hate it, penalties are here to stay.
Yes, they are.
All right, thank you, Jason Lim. That wraps up On The Ball for this week. Next up, Angeline Tay takes you through the world of body pump on BFM 89.9.
So the penalty shootout, let me just clarify, is where there's a penalty and they go like, okay, you get a free kick and you know, the opposing team stands in a row in front of the goal to try and, like, you know, prevent that, right?
Yeah, thank you very much.
This is Because We Can, the final part of Bar None, and I am Angeline Tate. This week, we'll be having a chat about body pump.
Hello, my name is Tiki Shabudin. Most folks just call me Tiki. I am a Les Mills body pump instructor.
Flat abs, lean legs, sculpted shoulders, strong arms. Great bodies aren't born, they are engineered. Tiki Shabudin, as you've just heard him, will guide us through what is body pump.
Body pump, easiest way to describe it, it's aerobics but with weights. Now, a typical body pump routine is essentially an hour long and it has 10 tracks. So we start off with the first track being your warm-up, where we use the lightest weights and we start just warming up the body generally. So as an example, this is a warm-up song, and I'll just take you through a quick routine. The song is starting to build up. We start to do a shoulder roll just to warm it up. And let's begin with a deadlift, two and two. Down two counts and up two counts. And down two counts again and up two counts. Repeat two more times. And now drop and hold. Drop into your knees and then hold right there. So basically, that's just an example of what we do in the warm-ups, and that's just to give you an example. Second track is your squats, where we're working the glutes and your thigh muscles, your quad, and you're using the heaviest weights and you're doing squats, basically. Now for the squats, you have a song that's a little bit more upbeat, simply because this is where you're going to be feeling a lot of pain. As you can hear, you can tell, the music's a bit more upbeat. And what we're doing here is we're doing squats. We're going to start slowly. This is a 2-2, two counts down, two counts up. Now you can imagine your knees are in line with your toes and you're pushing your butt back and you're doing a squat with weights on your shoulders. So there you go. And these are the heaviest weights. For myself, I carry roughly about 35 to 40 kilos on my back when I'm doing my squats. Now you might be thinking, that's easy, 40 kilos. I could do that. Yes, but you have to remember, this song is 6 minutes long, and there's no stopping. You do not stop once you start. third track is your chest track, where we start working on the chest. So we start doing chest presses and also chest push-ups, diamond push-ups and things like that. Fourth track, which is actually a lot of a highlight for me, simply because it's where you strengthen your back. It's where you work all your posterior chain of muscles, shoulders, lower back, upper back, glutes again. And then on the fifth track, we start working on the arms, starting with the triceps, the back of the arm. And then the sixth track, you work on the biceps, the front of the arms, your guns. Seventh track, we go back to the legs again, but this time we work on the calves and the hamstrings, lunges. On the eighth, we start working the shoulders. The ninth track is where you work your core, the abs. And finally, the tenth track is where you cool down. So that's essentially the whole body pump routine right there, 60 minutes.
So what's the rep effect?
In regular bodybuilding, in an hour, you're probably doing probably close to about 100 repetitions. That means 100 repetitions of one exercise. And a body pump routine in 1 hour, you're doing over 800 repetitions. Oh, yes. So because of that, you don't bulk up. Contrary to popular belief, a lot of people, especially for those who have seen a body pump before, some people are afraid of it, especially the ladies, because they think they're going to be looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's, no, relax, ladies, you can't bulk up.
You consciously don't know how much you're doing, right?
No, because the music's pumping and you're following the timing, so it's actually choreographed.
If a person who's never done this, this sounds a bit extreme, and you know, how do you know what weights to take?
In fact, that's what the instructor's there for. If you go up to the instructor and say, hey, I'm a first timer, what they'll have you do is essentially take the lightest weights. They might even ask you what sounds like a personal question. It's not. They'll ask you how heavy you are. Okay, because based on your body weight, they'll adjust. They know how to estimate what kind of weight you might want to start with. And again, I cannot stress this enough. It is completely safe if done correctly. Now, just as an example, I used to be 135 kilos, and I used to wear size 46 pants. I also have two sets of herniated discs, L4, L5, and I have spondylosis on C4 through C7. As a result, I was actually paralyzed on my left side. And you might be wondering, wait a minute, body pump, wouldn't it be a little bit detrimental to someone like me? As you can see, obviously the listeners can't see this, but Angeline can attest to this. I'm no longer 135 kilos. I no longer wear size 46 pants. The reason is because of body pump.
So what are the benefits?
Well, number one, if I've had participants tell me they're no longer on their heart medication. I've had participants come up and tell me that they're no longer hypertensive. I had a client who was hypertensive and he was on medication. After about a month of body pump, his readings were completely normalized and no medication. He's no longer taking medication.
Any disadvantages of body pump?
If done incorrectly, because posture is extremely important in body pump, because if you don't practice the proper posture, you can get injured very easily because you are playing with the weights.
And anybody can just join and walk into a
Absolutely.
Body pump. Where can we look for these classes?
Anywhere that has the Les Mills programs, anywhere you see, like, for example, True Fitness, Celebrity Fitness, Fitness First, Elements Gym, Chi Fitness. These are just some of the gyms just off the bat. But if you were to go to the lesmills.com website, you can actually see a whole bunch of gyms that actually support their programs. So Body Pump, Body Combat, all those are all Les Mills programs.
And what do you do, you know, to keep your participants motivated and keep coming back every week?
Oh, that's easy. I don't even have to do a thing.
Really?
Even after the first or second, even after the second or third session, you already start to see results. And that's the beauty of body pump. More so than any other type of workout, you see results even as short as within a week.
So sweat it or skip it. Try out for a body pump session that might just work for you. This is Angeline for Bar None.
And that's all for Bar None this week. Remember, if you're passionate about a sport or activity and want to share that excitement with us, just email us at barnone@bfm.my. You can also follow us on Facebook by liking our page, facebook.com/bfmbarnone. Thank you for listening. This is Audrey Raj, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.